Part 5. Stuff just keeps on getting older. The Mystery of the Primeval Mounds. Chapter 18. Sun. From the city of Manaus, at the heart of the Amazon River Basin in South America, it's a journey of about 6,000 kilometers by air to reach the city of St. Louis in the heart of the Mississippi River Basin in North America. On the way, you'll cross the equator and the Tropic of Cancer. Google informs me that the flight time will be about 11 hours, including a stopover in the Dominican Republic. It wasn't so simple in the ancient world. Although sections of the journey could have been made by sea, most of the route would have been overland, through some geographically very challenging parts of Central America and involving, ultimately, much more than 6,000 kilometers. This is not to say that such a great distance must necessarily have ruled out any communication and interchange between the two regions. On the contrary, it is not in dispute that the peoples of South and North America are more closely related genetically to each other than they are to anyone else, that there are some linguistic connections, and that crops such as maize or manioc that had been domesticated in one region were also grown in the other, though sometimes with a significant time lag. In summary, the evidence confirms that there were contacts, but it also suggests that they were random and infrequent rather than regular and sustained. What, then, are we to make of the fact that stunningly similar earthworks, repeating stunningly similar geometric themes on a stunningly similar scale to those of the Amazon River Basin, are also found in the Mississippi River Basin? Are the resemblances coincidental? Or did they arise during one of the random and infrequent episodes of contact? Or is there some other explanation? It's June 14th, 2017, a week before the summer solstice, and I'm chewing over these questions with Santha while we stand on top of an earthwork called Monk's Mound at the sacred heart of the ancient Mississippian city of Cahokia. Looking southwest from this vantage point, what stands out, about 8 miles away, are the twin A-shaped support towers and cable ties of the Stan Musial Veterans Memorial Bridge joining Illinois to Missouri across the Mississippi River, and a couple of miles further south along the Mississippi waterside, the glittering, stainless steel gateway arch of the city of St. Louis. Conceived as a public memorial to the men who made possible the Western territorial expansion of the United States, the arch reaches a height of 630 feet and is claimed to be the tallest man-made monument in the Western Hemisphere and the tallest arch in the world. The contrast between old and new is abrupt, for the ancient mounds and earthworks of the Mississippi Valley, even gigantic sites like Cahokia, have an understated quality. They don't radiate the brash and boastful self-importance of so many of our modern structures, such as the skyscraper One Metropolitan Square, which at 593 feet high seems to do battle with the Gateway Arch to dominate the St. Louis skyline. Neither do they overwhelm you with their grandeur and their majesty, like the pyramids of ancient Egypt and Mexico. Nor do they wear their mysteries in full view, like the great Moai of Easter Island. Instead, an elegant synthesis between heaven and earth seems to have been sought out. In consequence, even Monk's Mound, on the 100-foot-tall summit of which we're now standing, is so seamlessly integrated with its setting that it seems almost as much a work of nature as of man. Indeed, this was precisely the view of Dr. A. R. Crook, director of the Illinois State Museum and a geologist by training, who undertook the first scientific investigation of Monk's Mound in 1914. His theory, shared by many of his colleagues at the time and perhaps colored by an underlying prejudice that prehistoric Native Americans would not have been capable of building on such a scale, was that the mounds of Cahokia were entirely natural erosional remnants. In 1914, Crook drilled 25 shallow auger holes into the north face of Monk's Mound, found nothing to change his view, and as late as 1921 was continuing to declare, as though it were an established and objective fact, that the mounds were merely glacial and alluvial deposits and thus of no archaeological interest. This mattered because other, wiser scholars were already absolutely certain that the Cahokia complex was man-made and of outstanding archaeological interest, and had mounted a campaign to save the mounds from further destruction at the hands of farmers and industrialists. Crook's claims that they were natural formations were therefore most unhelpful and had to be refuted before further progress could be made. The challenge was duly taken up by archaeologist Warren T. Moorhead, who joined forces with geologist Maurice Layton to undertake a much more thorough investigation of the mounds in 1922 than Crook had mounted in 1914. After several test pits had been dug on the fourth terrace and on the east side of Monk's Mound, including auguring to a depth of 20 feet, the results in the form of artifacts and exposed construction levels were too conclusive and compelling to be dismissed. Even Crook was convinced, and thereafter abandoned his position that the mounds were natural features, a position that today, in the light of subsequent extensive excavations around Cahokia and at Monk's Mound, seems absurd. Nonetheless, there remain many who would seek by one means or another to take Cahokia away from the Native Americans who built it. Since it can no longer be credibly claimed as a natural erosional feature, the fallback position, popular in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, but repeatedly returned to even now, is that the great city, and others like it, up and down the Mississippi Valley, must have been the work of some superior master race of white-skinned foreigners who reached America in antiquity and built the mounds with their advanced skills and techniques, but were then driven off or wiped out by native savages. Frequently compounded by rumors of giants or aliens, such reasoning has already been comprehensively refuted by excavations proving to the satisfaction of anyone capable of logical thought that the mounds, including Monk's Mound, that stupendous pile of earth, as one early explorer described it, are indeed the work of Native Americans. The very name of the Great Mound, however, demonstrates the effects of the ongoing casual misappropriation of indigenous achievements. It bears that name simply because a group of Trappist monks, immigrants from France, grew vegetables on its terraces for a few years either side of AD 1810. But it was built around AD 1050 by the Native American civilization archaeologists call the Mississippians. We don't know what the people of that civilization called themselves, and we don't know what they called Monk's Mound. We do know, however, that they thought and worked on a grand scale, as I shall show, and that they made use of the same kinds of geometry and astronomy deployed at Serpent Mound, 420 miles to the east, and in the great earthworks and mounds of the Amazon, thousands of miles to the south. Two Valleys. Despite the promising clues offered by ethnographic research into the likely role played by vision-inducing plants and shamanic experiences, the fact remains that we are confronted across huge expanses of the Amazon by such severely limited archaeological data that it's impossible to give responsible, informed answers to three fundamental questions. What motivated the creation of the mounds and geoglyphs? When were the very first structures of this kind made? Where and how were the requisite design, planning, engineering, and architectural skills developed? In the Amazon, on all three counts, we simply don't know. Moreover, our ignorance is compounded by the absence of any detailed geometrical or archaeoastronomical surveys of the earthworks and mounds thus far discovered, and by the fact that millions of square kilometers of the rainforest have never been studied by archaeologists at all. It's quite a different story in the Mississippi Valley, which is not veiled by vast areas of near impenetrable jungle, and where mounds and earthworks remarkably similar to those now coming to light in the Amazon have been the subject of more than 170 years of intensive archaeological investigation. Because they were always in plain view, however, and because they often occupied land that was desirable for agricultural or industrial purposes, the vast majority of the immense prehistoric structures of the Mississippi Valley no longer exist. An estimated 90% are gone, either partially or completely demolished and cleared away in the obliteration of North America's past that began with the European conquest. So just as archaeologists in the Amazon have only a limited database from which to construct their theories because the jungle covers so much, it's also the case that archaeologists in the Mississippi Valley have only a limited database because so much has been destroyed. Still, they've achieved a great deal with the roughly 10% of the original total of sites that have survived, And it may not be too much to hope that their discoveries could shed light on the mysterious counterpart mounds and earthworks of the Amazon. Earth Island, Sky World. From Chapter 16, the listener may recall Severino Calazans, an Amazonian earthwork with the same 13-acre footprint and the same orientation to the cardinal directions as the Great Pyramid of Giza. Though rectangular rather than square, 910 feet from north to south and 720 feet from east to west, Monk's Mound has a 14-acre footprint. Considered as a pyramid, and it is indeed a form of step pyramid, it comes third in the Americas after the Pyramid of Quetzalcoatl at Cholula and the Pyramid of the Sun at Teotihuacan, both of which are stone-reinforced monuments and significantly taller. Considered as an earthwork, and echoing that early explorer's report, Monk's Mound has been described as stupendous in many ways. It is the tallest mound, covers the most area, and contains the most volume of any prehistoric earthen monument in the Americas. It is, moreover, part of a giant complex with multiple different elements, including more than 100 subsidiary earthen mounds, the archaeological traces of what was once a spectacular circle of huge wooden posts, known as Cahokia's Woodhenge, a spacious central plaza, and an 18-meter-wide, 800-meter-long earthwork causeway running arrow straight between raised embankments. Enigmatically but quite deliberately set to an azimuth of 005 degrees, that is, 5 degrees east of true north, it is this causeway, referred to by archaeologists as the Rattlesnake Causeway, that defines Cahokia's principal axis, giving the site a certain ambiguity and adding to its air of mystery. Every mound and earthwork is set out upon the ground in strict relation to it, with clusters of structures dominated by Monk's Mound itself, running south to north, and other clusters running west to east. It's easy to understand, then, why the first and most powerful impression I get overlooking this massive ancient site from the top of Monk's Mound is of its distinct cardinality, exactly as is the case at Giza and Angkor, both of which are aligned within fractions of a single degree to true north, so too here at Cahokia. Despite its puzzling 5-degree offset, there's no mistaking where to look for the cardinal directions. Something about the place, something intended and carefully thought through by its original designers, immediately connects you to both earth and sky. This sense of terrestrial and cosmic connectedness is among several cogently argued reasons why archaeologist William Romaine, whose work at Serpent Mound we encountered in Part 1, considers Monk's Mound to have been conceived by its designers as a true axis mundi, intended to serve as a junction point between heaven and earth. He reminds us of the traditional shamanistic spiritual system of the Native American peoples of the Eastern Woodlands, the region of Cahokia. According to this system, the universe is comprised of an above world, this world, and below world. Connecting these realms is a vertical vector, the axis mundi, that enables shamans to move between cosmic realms. The axis mundi can be symbolically represented by any number of vertical elements such as a pole, tree, column of smoke, mountain, pyramid, or mound. Monk's Mound has the look of a small mountain, Romaine observes. It dwarfs everything in the surrounding landscape and utterly dominates Cahokia. This character of verticality is enhanced by the local topography of the Mississippi floodplain, which would have ensured that the Grand Plaza was regularly, if shallowly, inundated. Out of the watery, marshy realm thus created, Monk's Mound would have seemed to rear up in numinous and mythic power, and was perhaps, Romaine writes, imagined as an earth island. If the below world, as represented by the wetlands, swamps, lakes, and man-made water features surrounding central Cahokia, is a watery world, then it is appropriate that in its verticality, Monk's Mound would be the structural axis mundi linking the watery below world to the above sky world. Interestingly, and again despite the 5-degree offset from true north so firmly declared by Cahokia's principal axis, the largest known building of the Mississippian civilization was erected on the apex of Monk's Mound, and in this case was precisely aligned to the cardinal directions. Its long axis, measuring 30.85 meters, was set perfectly east-west, its short axis, measuring 13.85 meters, was set perfectly north-south. Romain also draws our attention to the powerful visual hierophany that would have been witnessed at the spring and fall equinoxes when Cahokia was in its prime, locking the sight in to key conjunctions of heaven and earth. It was in the staging of this hierophany that the site's Woodhenge played its most crucial role. Recreated with a modern simulacrum for the benefit of the 300,000 tourists who now visit Cahokia each year, and named after the similar prehistoric circle of huge wooden posts that stood on England's Salisbury Plain, close to the world-famous site of Stonehenge before the stone circle itself was completed, Cahokia's Woodhenge lies some 850 metres west of Monk's Mound. Its existence remained unsuspected until the 1960s, when archaeologist Warren Whittry found traces of immense postholes. Subsequent excavations revealed that no fewer than 5 Woodhenges had been built on the same site over a period of a couple of centuries in order to accommodate increases in the size and shape of the mound itself, which affected crucial solar sight lines. The objective of every realignment and rededication was that an observer at the center of the post circle, looking due east across the front sight of a specially placed equinox marker post, should see the sun's disk appear above the slope of the southern terrace of Monk's Mound, an arrangement, says Romain, that establishes an east-west solar-oriented line across the entire Cahokia complex. The result is that Monk's Mound is visually connected to the above world vis-à-vis the rising sun and its location on the east-west sight line that intersects the major sight axis. In this way, Monk's Mound is positioned at a center place. The assertion and manifestation of centrality is reconfirmed by 2 other posts at Woodhenge, which serve as front sights, targeting the horizon azimuths of the summer and winter solstice sunrises. Enter the moon. The circles, rectangles, and squares of Cahokia, the solstitial and equinoctial alignments, and the perfect cardinality of the large structure that once stood atop Monk's Mound are among the hallmarks of the same distinct pattern of geometry and astronomy that we find in the Amazon earthworks. Unexplained so far, however, is why Cahokia's designers made a deliberate choice not to align the main axis of their premier site to the cardinal directions of earth and sky, but instead chose to offset it by 5 degrees east of true north. It's a question to which William Romain offers an intriguing answer. The builders of Cahokia, he argues, were geometricians who made use of a special rectangle known as a root 2 rectangle in planning the layout of the city. He gives much supporting evidence for this claim, which need not detain us here. Nor do we want to get bogged down in unnecessary technical detail. In brief, however, a root 2 rectangle is constructed by extending the opposite sides of a square to the length of the square's diagonal. If you take such a rectangle, orient it to true north, 0 degrees azimuth, and then rotate it eastwards by 5 degrees to match the azimuth of Cahokia's principal axis, its diagonals turn out to align closely with important solar and lunar events as viewed from Monk's Mound, specifically the summer solstice sunrise at azimuth 59.7 degrees, the winter solstice sunset at azimuth 239.3 degrees, the moon's maximum southern rising position at azimuth 130.1 degrees, and the moon's maximum northern setting position at azimuth 307.1 degrees. The match, Romain admits, is not perfect. A couple of the celestial azimuths differ from the diagonals of the root 2 rectangle by 2 or 3 degrees, but since the rectangle is not intended for observational purposes, it is perhaps close enough to symbolically represent the complementary opposite relationships of the sun and the moon. If Romain is right, then it appears that sophisticated astronomical and mathematical ideas, combined with complex and cleverly thought-through symbolism, were already present, fully worked out and in the hands of competent professionals when Cahokia underwent what archaeologists call its Big Bang, an explosive period of expansion and development around AD 1050. Is there evidence that such ideas were deployed elsewhere in North America before Cahokia?